It's time for Northwestern Outdoors Radio, the show focusing on fishing, hunting, outdoor recreation, destinations, and conservation in the region where you live and play. Northwestern Outdoors is brought to you by Max Lure Company, Sportsman's Warehouse, and Wallowa County. And now, let's see what's going on in the field and on the water with your host, John Cruz.
Looking for a fun fishing vacation this year? Consider a trip to the Cowboy State. If you go to the Wyoming Game and Fish website and the fishing page there, you'll find a tab where you can check out regional fishing day trips. Exploring this region-by-region guide, I found not only are there recommended day trips, but recommended fishing for up to 3 days. Take Northeast Wyoming, for example. You can fish your first day on the North Tongue River, catching 4 different species of trout. On your second day, you can start off at Clean Burn Ponds just north of Sheridan and catch yourself some bass, perch, crappie, and catfish. Want more warm water fishing? Head east from Sheridan to Keyhole Reservoir, known as a great warm water fishery, especially for walleye and northern pike. Those are just a few of the suggestions for Northeast Wyoming. You can check out the others and the other regional fishing trip suggestions too at the Wyoming Game and Fish website. This week on Northwestern Outdoors Radio, we're going to get a chance to chat with Casey Kaiser. He owns a Jeep and loves to go on overland adventures into the vast and remote desert found in Southeast Oregon. You can follow his adventures, which he documents on video through his YouTube channel, Coyote Works. The whole concept of overland camping and travel is a lot different than your typical car camping vacation at a state or national park, that's for sure. And as you'll hear from Casey, sometimes things can go very wrong, and when they do, you are on your own. It being January, it is prime time for ice fishing, and Montana fishing guide Mike Howe will join us for an extended Max Minute to help you size up any frozen lake you run across that holds perch and crappie, and better still, he's going to give you some tips on how to catch those fish once you find them. After that, we've got your monthly roundup of outdoors news from the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, which includes news about not one, but 2 state records that fell last month to anglers in the Gem State. We've also got the latest on what's going on this winter with sportsman shows, to include what's scheduled to go, what's been postponed to later dates, and what's been canceled as we continue to deal with COVID pandemic event restrictions. On top of this, we'll get to chat with my old friend Tug Tuggle. Tug is retired from a long career with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, so long that it was the Washington Department of Fisheries when he joined, and he wrote a book about his time there. The title is Fish Cop, and if you're one that tends to think that the good old days were always good when it came to fishing, some of the stories Tug will share may remind you about how divisive and riotous it was on the rivers of Washington and Oregon in the 1970s, about as divisive and riotous as they have been on the streets of Portland and Seattle in 2020. We'll wrap things up with your Sportsman's Warehouse trivia question of the weekend, some news about Sportsman's Warehouse too. Before we get into all this good stuff though, let's kick things off with this weekend's edition of Sportsman Spotlight with David Sparks.
Care to feed your hunting dog with a protein-rich dietary supplement? Something that'll give him energy and vitality? Stay tuned, I might have a surprise for you. David Sparks, Sportsman Spotlight. Known as health powerhouses, Pulse Crops pack a serious punch when it comes to their dietary benefits. Pulse Crops are rich in important nutrients, including fiber, protein, folate, potassium, and iron. Pulse Crops are a viable and sustainable source of nutrients and protein in the pet food market. Chickpeas, lentils, and dried peas have become popular ingredients in pet foods, especially grain-free pet foods. I asked Jeff Van Pevenage, CEO of Columbia Grain International, if Pulse Crops added to dog food would help a hunting dog.
Absolutely. You know, it helps promote shinier coats. It's really a very healthy alternative for pet food. So you get improved skin health, your dog's energy level is better, improves your dog's breath. Frankly, an easier food for dogs to digest. And it contains more protein than grain-based dog food. So if your dog is a go-get-em hunting dog, a work dog, that's what you want.
So look at the labels of your dog food, and if it has chickpeas, dried beans, lentils, or dried peas, you're probably good to go. Or make that your dog is probably good to go.
Want to get into the fish? Then head to the Olympic Peninsula. Excel Fishing Charters will get you into salmon near CQ, where you can keep two Chinook a day, or bottom fishing out of Mia Bay, where an abundant limit of rockfish and lingcod await. You'll be fishing in a comfortable boat with Tom Burlingame, and if you need a place to stay, he's got you covered at the Inn at Mia Bay. Book today at excelfishingcharters.com.
This is Bob. I can show you how to make $1,000 a day.
This is an alert. In 2018, 48 billion robocalls were placed to cell phones, and nearly 50% of those were scam-related. Scammers want money, personal information, and sensitive identity information. They use insurance and free vacation gimmicks as tools to get your cash and identities. Farmers, you have even more to lose when it comes to scams. Identity theft can really damage the day-to-day operations of the farm when your personal information is tied to farm accounts. If you're buying or selling items online, such as farm equipment, expect and know how to spot a potential scam. Watch for area codes that aren't local and make no sense. Another tip, scammers don't know farm lingo, so feel them out. Since robocalls are the number one complaint to the Federal Communications Commission, the U.S. Senate is now discussing a bill to make robocalls a criminal action, which would stop the calls. We urge you to call your senator today. Robocalls are robber calls. Hope you enjoyed Sportsman Spotlight. I'm David Sparks.
You're back with Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz, and I don't know about you, but I've been spending a lot of time during this pandemic in front of my computer and on my cell phone surfing YouTube. Normally, it's kind of a boring thing to do, but I found something I've just got to share. You need to go to a channel called Coyote Works. When you do, you're going to find a man named Casey Kaiser, and he spends a lot of time in his Jeep traveling throughout the deserts of Southeast Oregon and going on some spectacular adventures and dishing out some advice so you can do some overland adventuring yourself. We've got Casey on the line. Casey, welcome to the show.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, and I got to tell you, I've absolutely fallen in love with your channel and all the adventures you're having. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about overland camping in the very remote country of Southeast Oregon?
Yeah, absolutely. So two things. The first thing I would say is, as far as overlanding goes, a lot of people have heard that term, but I find that not a lot of people really understand exactly what it means. And to me, the spirit of overland style camping, as opposed to just car camping or, you know, campground camping, is really the idea that you're predominantly going to explore and see country. And it usually consists of traveling during the day, making camp in the afternoon, and then packing up camp the next morning and moving on to another spot. So it's really more about the journey as opposed to the destination, I would say, is what really kind of differentiates my style of overland camping from your typical go out to a campground and stay in the same spot for a couple of nights. And having said that, the reason that I choose that style, or the reason that style works really well for me, is that my goal is really to see the most remote places left in the West, and predominantly Oregon. We live in, you know, right where I live in Central Oregon, I'm right on kind of the northwest corner of some of the lowest population density area left in the entire United States. And my goal is really to find those places that you've probably never heard of, uncover the remnants of the history that are still left out there, and just really enjoy seeing places that not too many other people get to see.
Let's talk a little bit about your means of travel. You have a Jeep, and you know there's a lot of people that travel Jeep tracks like you two, but why do you prefer the Jeep over other vehicles, over maybe a pickup truck or maybe, you know, something from Toyota like a Land Cruiser?
Yeah, great question, and one that I get asked all the time. So the first thing I like to say is I have absolutely no relationship with Jeep whatsoever. I could be driving any kind of vehicle I want. The reason I've kind of chosen the Jeep and stuck with it, and the one I'm driving now is my fourth one, so I've had, for the most part, pretty good luck with them, is really they're one of the most capable off-road vehicles that you can buy that are set up that way right from the factory. The Rubicon model Jeep has locking differentials front and rear, electronic disconnecting sway bars, plenty of ground clearance, steel bumpers front and rear, good approach and departure angles. So from a capability perspective, it's about one of the best vehicles for sure that you can buy straight off of the factory. Now, the second thing is just more the configuration of the vehicle. That four-door SUV is just a size the passenger and cargo compartments inside it, give you the ability to put all of your gear in there, keep it out of the weather so you don't have too much stuff and like in the back of a pickup or on your roof or things like that. So a good Jeep set up with a rooftop tent just makes a perfect rig. It's a nice size. It can get into tight spots and stuff. And that's a little bit of kind of why I landed there.
A couple things that really interest me about what you do. I travel a lot, but when I travel, I'm usually traveling like several hundred miles in a day. When you do this overland camping, you might travel all day and what, cover 30, 50 miles just because of the, I shouldn't say roads, but the trails that you're traveling over?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that is really something. You get out in that desert country, and one thing that we do is we measure distance in time rather than miles, right? So the miles really don't mean a lot. The amount of time that it takes to cross a mile is really dependent on the trail conditions or lack thereof. So, you know, you might say, oh, such and such place is a half day's drive from here. One of my roughest trails that I've had recently was a stretch of trail that took me 6 hours to cross 11 miles of trail in my Jeep.
Wow.
So that's really, yeah, you get into, a lot of times I'm following old wagon roads or old historic routes that were, you know, kind of developed primarily for oxen, horse teams pulling wagons or buckboards or things like that. And they've eroded and washed away over the years. So in a lot of cases, there's not much left that I'm following.
Speaking of these historic trails, that's one thing I love is the history, especially the Old West history that you stumble into on your travels, whether it be homesteads or stage stops or old ranches. You're almost like a history detective when you find these places and start figuring out exactly how life was for the people who lived there back then.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And that's one of the things that I really love is the fact that in this desert country, this drier climate where we live, that history is preserved so well. So oftentimes what happens is I have kind of a broad knowledge of some history that happened in an area. And then once I get on the ground there, I start looking for little clues. And oftentimes it's just as simple as a tin can or a trace of an old wagon road, something to give me a starting point that I can kind of start searching out from there. And maybe I find an old board, maybe I find a real faint, you know, row of rocks that just it doesn't look natural. And pretty soon you start putting all the clues together and kind of honing in on what happened. And that's oftentimes, you know, to me, that's kind of the magic of it is when you start getting enough physical clues to really start putting together the story of what happened on the ground there. And it may have been a stage stop or a homesteading family or an old community. But that process, like you said, of putting the puzzle pieces together, that's a big part of what drives me. It's like an infinitely sized Rubik's Cube out there. And it just needs getting out there to start putting those pieces together and figure out what happened. And that history is disappearing is another thing that drives me, you know, is while this country does preserve it well, more of it disappears every year that goes by.
You know, you're absolutely right about that, but I absolutely love what you're sharing on YouTube. Again, folks, the channel is Coyote Works. That's where you want to go on YouTube. The person that is putting these wonderful overland adventure videos together is Casey Kaiser. Most of them take place in the remote deserts of Southeast Oregon. Having been in that country, I mean, this is really remote. There's no cell phone coverage in most of it. There's no people in most of it. And if something goes wrong, you're really on your own, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of the essence of my goal is getting to that country that not many other people get to. And by virtue of that, it means I'm oftentimes a long ways away, even from areas where I'm likely to run into people. So it's not uncommon for me to spend 2-3 days out in the desert backcountry and not see another person or vehicle the entire time.
And sometimes things go wrong, to include your famous, or should I say infamous, video where you're 25 miles from the closest road where you expect to find somebody, your Jeep catches on fire and burns up right in front of you on the video.
That was definitely an adventure that I'll remember for the rest of my life. Yeah, I pulled up to a cattle gate to open it up, and as I got out of my Jeep, I noticed a little what I thought was steam coming out from underneath the hood. So, you know, I assume a real common thing is leaky radiator, a pinhole in a radiator hose or something. So I just popped the hood latches, threw the hood up, and
the engine compartment kind of erupted into flames, I guess, when the oxygen hit it, and ended up with quite a fire on my hands. I had a couple of fire extinguishers that I attempted to put it out with, but it was just too far into plastic and oil and things like that. So I quickly switched from trying to put it out to trying to get enough gear out of the Jeep that I could be comfortable and survive out there for a little while if I had to. And that was kind of it. The next 4 hours were cutting fire line around it. It was in late August, so it was really dry out there. And so I had to keep it from starting the woods on fire or starting the brush on fire, number one. And number two, basically just get myself prepped for who knows how long it was going to take me to get myself out of that.
It is something to see, folks. You've got to watch that video and all the other ones, too. We are out of time, but didn't even get to another part that I really like about your videos. It's the great advice you have for people camping, whether it's cooking food, whether it's building a fire, whether it's the deliberate choice of exactly where to set up a camp. You've got some great information that anybody who is doing overland adventuring or camping or just camping in a remote country can really use. The YouTube channel, again, folks, is Coyote Works. Check out Casey Kaiser's great channel there, full of adventures that you can enjoy anytime you want. Casey, keep up the great work. I look forward to talking to you more on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Thanks, John. It was a pleasure.
With more of the great outdoors on Northwestern Outdoors Radio with John Cruz.
It's time for another Max Minute, brought to you every week by Max Lure, and we've got Mike Howe on the line. He is a fishing guide located in Western Montana, specializes in ice fishing. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Great to be back.
So, Mike, I've got a question for you. Give us a basic drill of what you would do showing up at a lake you've never fished before and you want to try ice fishing it for the first time. We're just going to say that it has perch or crappie in it. How are you going to go about trying to break down this lake to catch some fish?
Sure. Well, you know, there's a lot of good lake maps around, more and more every year. If you've got a mapping program, then you're all set. You know, for perch, you're looking out in the flats. You want to be fairly close to some break lines. Crappie typically suspend out in the deeper water. So if you've got electronics, absolutely trust your electronics. Look for the flats for perch, basins for crappie, and always any shoreline structure, points, breaks coming out, that sort of thing, rock piles that you may know that's out there. Not much different from open water fishing, John, except you're typically fishing it 8 inches at a time.
When it comes to Max Lure products, what would you recommend using for any hypothetical lake?
Well, you know, that Sonic bait fish is probably one of the best ice fishing lures that's made, no matter what the target. You can fish it vertically, you can fish it horizontally, you can tip it with bait, you can fish it by itself, you can rip it hard and make a lot of noise, or you can fish it very subtly. You can even take the hooks off of that, John, if the fish are really finicky, and tie about a 4-inch dropper line and a small glow hook on the bottom of that. Tip it with a couple of maggots or a wax worm, and you're in business.
All right, there you go, folks. Breaking down a body of water covered with ice near you. That's Mike Howe. You can find out more about the ice fishing he offers in Montana, if you really want to learn from a pro, by going to aablefishing.com. That's aablefishing.com for his guide service, which offers both hard water and regular water fishing throughout Montana. Mike, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks, John. Have a great new year.
Wedding rings? I've had as many as I've got fingers on my hands. I started off with the Wedding Ring Classic, of course. That smooth blade from Indiana, that beaded body, the sharp hook. We caught a lot of trout together over the years, but then that patented Smile Blade wedding ring, well, let's just say it took my fancy, along with the trout and the kokanee. Now I'm going through this new age sort of phase. You might say I'm hooked on the new high UV colored wedding rings, and I'm catching more fish than ever. So yeah, I've got a whole bunch of wedding rings. You should get some too. Don't look at the jewelry store though. These wedding ring spinners are from Max Lure, and you'll find them at the sporting goods store near you or online at maxlure.com.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the voice for your public lands, waters, and wildlife. From the Canadian Yukon to the Florida Everglades, we're stepping up to conserve North America's public lands, defend our hunting and fishing traditions, and expand access to the outdoors. Find out how you can get involved at backcountryhunters.org.
Welcome back to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. It is a brand new year, and it's time for our monthly check-in with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. With us here to tell you what's going on in the great state of Idaho is Brian Pearson, Public Information Specialist for the agency. Brian, Happy New Year.
Thank you, John, and to you too.
So, Brian, I guess we ought to talk about a few things that happened at the tail end of 2020. And let's start off with a couple of new state record fish. One of them is a new state record tiger trout. Where was that caught? When was it caught? And how big was it?
Yeah, so this was our certified weight record program. And it was caught in our Upper Snake region, Becker Pond in Idaho Falls. It was a beautiful 4.8-pound tiger trout and 24 inches long. It was caught on December 16th. You know, we've got these tiger trout, these hybrid trout in a few different waters across the state. They can get really big, and, you know, it's a popular fishery, and this guy really got into a good one.
Do you have his name by chance? We ought to at least give him a shout out if you do.
Yeah, it's Gatlin Mays.
All right. Well, Gatlin, congratulations on that. Now, another state record was also caught, not exactly a game fish, but a very big fish, a carp.
Yeah, this is a very large carp caught in our Magic Valley region. It tipped the scales at 30 pounds and 4 ounces.
Man.
And, you know, the gentleman that caught it was Alex Veenstra from Hansen. He was actually out fishing for bass and using a crankbait when he hooked into this monster carp. And he beat the previous record by 10 pounds, which is pretty impressive.
You know, it's really interesting. I used to always think that the only way you were going to catch carp was fishing like night crawlers or corn right off the bottom. But then when I became a walleye angler, I started catching my crankbaits. And the first time I thought it was a fluke. By the 12th time I did it, I realized, no, these carp, they'll hit crankbaits. And this angler found out the same as a bass angler, too. But it's just amazing to me that they'll hit a crankbait.
Yeah, and it's a pretty fun surprise when you're expecting, you know, a bass in the neighborhood of 5 pounds and you end up with a 30-pound carp on the end of your line.
I agree. Well, congratulations to both those anglers. What a great way to end the year. Let's turn our attention to kind of a bad news story. I understand you had a whole bunch of ducks die and a fungal infection caused it. Where did this happen, and can you give us some more details?
Yeah, this came out of our salmon region, and there were about 100 mallards that were found dead near the city of Salmon. And all indications at this point are pointing towards a fungal infection. You know, state and federal officials are still kind of doing some follow-up work to make sure there were no additional factors that went into it. But yeah, this fungus, and I won't butcher the pronunciation for you, but it's often found in decaying vegetation, and So it appears that the die-off at this point has stopped. So whatever the source of the fungus was, it appears that that's gone away now. And so this kind of stuff does happen with relative frequency with waterfowl. There are die-offs, you know, throughout the country. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, as far as the, you know, the Pacific Flyway and the larger population of ducks, this is not a very big number of ducks. But in the salmon area, this was a large and unusual die-off.
That is an unusual story indeed, and I didn't know that's how it occurred, but it makes perfect sense if you've got this fungal-infected vegetation and these dabbling ducks are eating it, that, yeah, they're going to get those fungal infections and die. All right. Well, that might be a smaller story for a lot of folks. Let's talk about, in your opinion, the biggest story to come out of Idaho Department of Fish and Game in this really wacky 2020.
You know, John, it's a story that we maybe haven't put out ourselves or publicized, but I think the neatest story that came out of this year is we saw a pretty significant bump in fishing license sales, and with folks dealing with COVID and social distancing and all of the things that we've kind of had to do for the majority of this year, we've really seen people take to fishing in larger numbers than in the past with fishing license sales. And, you know, folks are really outdoors, enjoying the resource and appreciating the fishing opportunities that we offer in Idaho, which is kind of a cool story.
I agree. And I will say the one silver lining out of the COVID-19 pandemic is that people either discovered the outdoors for the first time or rediscovered the outdoors, and that is a good thing. Unfortunately, a lot of them rediscovered or discovered hunting too, to the point where the woods and fields of Idaho got very crowded. And in my opinion, as a non-resident, the biggest story was the reduction of non-resident tags for deer and elk that are now available. I know that those tags went on sale in early December. Are some of the areas already sold out?
Yeah, some of our more popular areas sold out very quickly, which was anticipated. You know, we had pretty large volume of non-resident license sales that day. So if your listeners weren't aware, we are now requiring non-residents to pick a deer unit for over-the-counter hunts. So if they're looking to hunt a specific unit, there's a possibility that it's sold out already if it's a more popular one. But, you know, there is also a chance that there are some tags available in the unit that they're used to hunting. And we would definitely encourage people to get on there and buy those early, because there's a chance that if they're available now, they may not be in the near future.
I would say there's a very good chance that those tags are going to sell out in the near future. So, yes, you definitely want to hop on the Idaho Department of Fish and Game website. We're going to let you go, but I'll tell you what. You know, there was some good news out of last year in terms of those records. There was some good news about more people fishing, and I hope that spills over into the new year with more people enjoying the outdoors. And, folks, great place to do it is the Gem State. They've got a lot for you there, whether you're an angler, whether you're a hunter, whether you want to enjoy their parks or just being outside. Idaho's all over the outdoors. Brian, look forward to talking to you next month, and I hope again that you have a very happy 2021.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure, and you have a happy new year too.
Next up, it is Sportsman Show season. That's the first quarter of every year, and let's tell you what's been canceled, what's been postponed, and what's still scheduled to go forward. We'll start off with the canceled shows. That includes the Western Idaho Fly Fishing Expo that was supposed to take place this weekend in Boise. The Great Rocky Show in Billings, scheduled for next weekend, that's been canceled too, as has the Fly Fishing Show in Linwood and the Wenatchee Valley Sportsman Show that normally takes place in February. Still hoping to go as scheduled is the Central Washington Sportsman Show in Yakima, February 19th through the 21st. Exposure Shows hopes to have their entire lineup go forward. That includes the Eugene Boat and Sportsman Show, February 5th through the 7th at the Lane County Event Center, and the Douglas County Sportsman Show in Roseburg, February 19th through the 21st. The Idaho Sportsman Show in Boise is still on schedule for March 4th through the 7th, as is the Central Oregon Sportsman Show, March 11th through the 14th, and the Bighorn Outdoor Adventure Show in Spokane, March 18th through the 21st. What's been postponed? We've got a few producers that have postponed January and February shows and are moving them to later dates, hoping they'll go forward. That includes the Tri-City Sportsman Show, which has been moved to February 26th through the 28th at the Happo Center in Pasco. The Tacoma RV Show will take place at the Tacoma Dome, March 4th through the 7th, and the Washington Sportsman Show, normally at the fairgrounds in Puyallup in January, has been moved to the same location, March 17th through the 21st. Finally, the Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show will be combined with the Portland Boat Show, and both are scheduled to take place at the Expo Center in Portland, March 24th through the 28th. And if this one goes off, it will be the biggest sportsman show in the entire nation. I do know show producers are taking lots of extra steps to keep these shows safe to attend, but in the end, it's going to be state and local governments that will need to give the green light for these events to go forward. So, cross your fingers, do what you can between now and then to limit the spread of COVID, and let's hope for the best.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter and has what you need as a hunter, angler, hiker, paddler, camper, and outdoors enthusiast. They also carry an extensive assortment of firearms and ammunition you simply can't find anymore at many big box stores. On top of that, their knowledgeable staff is here to help you purchase the right gear so you can get the most out of your outdoor experience. Visit your local Sportsman's Warehouse store today or shop online anytime at sportsmans.com.
Are you looking to reel in the marketing opportunity of a lifetime? Then set the hook, because we've got it right here for you. America Outdoors Radio has sponsorships available, and we offer affordable platforms to reach thousands of listeners interested in fishing, hunting, and the outdoors. Find out more by contacting John Cruz through his website at AmericaOutdoorsRadio.com.
Welcome back to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. I've got my old friend on the line. His name is Tug. Actually, it's Jim Tuggle, but he goes by Tug, and he's a retired officer with the Washington Department of Fisheries. You see, before there was the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, there was the Game Department and the Fisheries Department, and Tug spent quite a bit of time as a fish cop, and he's written a new book about it, too, called Appropriately Fish Cop. Tug, welcome to the show and congrats on the book.
Thank you, John. Good morning.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was reading some of the true stories of cases and times that you dealt with as a fish cop in Washington State. Tell our listeners a little bit more about your book and about your career.
My career started really in the Army. I was a military policeman, an MT, and I had some biological college courses and always been interested in outdoor stuff, especially fishing. So I got hired in July of 71 and stationed, if you will, with the Department of Fisheries in Puget Sound. I lived in Issaquah, worked all over Puget Sound, a lot of commercial fishing, salmon fishing enforcement there, and checking dealers like fish houses and things like that. And then in the fall, of course, we were all over the streams, the big streams like the Nisqually and the Green River, that sort of thing, when the salmon came in and people were doing the wrong things to get them. And a couple of years after working Puget Sound, I moved to Kelso and worked the Columbia River, loved that, and was there for the next 10 years. Chasing people up and down the Columbia River and in all the tributary streams. And it was exciting. A lot of things happened in that era from 71 to about 1981, including the Bolt decision, a lot of gill net closures, and just made for an interesting career. And nobody has told the stories that I am telling in the book. They touched on Bolt, but not the way I saw it. I was involved right in the middle of it in the transition from the commercial fishing to the Indian rights decision, from the Bolt decision, and all the conflicts that caused. So people encouraged me to go back and write a book about it. And that fed my ego, of course. It took a long time to write the book, but I have done it over about a 10-year period.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Bolt decision. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, but as I recall, the Bolt decision was a court decision by Judge Bolt, where he basically said that the Native Americans who live here in the Northwest are able to fish in their accustomed areas that they have fished, and not just on the reservations. And not only that, they are essentially able to get 50% of any run in terms of allocation. Is that about right?
That is very accurate. And as fisheries officers, we were directed to kind of keep that in check prior to the Bolt decision. And we pulled it with a lot of nets, and then along came Bolt, and that was United States versus Washington State. Judge Bolt determined that there had to be a sharing of harvestable fish, 50% going to the tribes where they'd never had that before. And what it did is it put commercial fishermen on the beach. Commercial fishermen in Puget Sound had a really, really good life and made some money with big investments, and it took at least half the catch away from them. So guess who got to enforce this new decision? It was the fisheries officers from Washington State on Puget Sound, and I write about that, and there was quite a bit of violence in enforcing that.
There certainly was. As a matter of fact, you have one story in there where you firmly believe that one gill netter who was mistaken for being associated with test fisheries that were designed to determine the allocation of fish, might have been murdered out there on the Columbia River.
Yes, I'm convinced that that happened by some irate, berserk sport fisherman, actually.
You know, it's funny. You look back at the 70s. We think now that people are so angry, but you take a look back at the 70s and you take a look at the issues over gill netting. There was a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger on the part of the tribal members. There's a lot of anger on the part of the gill netters. There's a lot of anger on the part of a sport fisherman. Nobody felt like they were getting their fair share, did they?
No, they didn't. Especially now, they don't think so. And I think people are angry at the Department of Fish and Wildlife now after this combination, and they're really disappointed in the salmon and steelhead management, which has not done well in the last 40 years I've been involved in. In fact, it's an embarrassing failure, I think, to the Department of Fish and Wildlife on the salmon management issue. It's a real bad situation, and there's quite a few organizations willing to and have already filed lawsuits against the department for the poor salmon management and some outcomes of that. I don't cover that in the book, but that's just the state of the game right now.
Yeah, that would be a whole other book. That'll be your second book, Tug. So
yeah, maybe the third.
Again, folks, you're listening to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. We're talking to my friend Tug Tuggle. He is the author of Fish Cop, and it's a series of stories about his time as a fisheries patrol officer for the state of Washington. Spent a lot of time in Puget Sound, spent a lot of time in the Columbia River. A couple things that jumped out at me. Back in the 1970s, when you were working Puget Sound, I didn't know that you didn't need a license to gather shellfish or crabs.
No, you didn't even need a license to fish for salmon or halibut or anything like that. That came along later when I think the department was looking for revenue and some matching funds from federal Fish and Wildlife when you sell licenses. So razor clam season was open year-round for a while and just regulated by the tides. You didn't need a license to fish for salmon. You didn't need a license to crab or anything. Those were the days, and it were days of plenty, really. The ocean was open to fishing for salmon from April to October. Puget Sound was open the year-round. The Columbia in the mid-70s had a few closures to protect spring salmon, especially, starting, I think, about 74, 75.
When did you retire from the Department of Fisheries or the Department of Fish and Wildlife?
August 1st, 1999, and then I went to work as a wilderness fishing guide in Southeast Alaska.
Amazing, amazing. So, you know, you were in the game for a long time. What's different now for those young people who are starting off as enforcement officers at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife or Oregon State Police troopers who are in that field, or wardens who are working in Idaho? What's different now versus what you had to go through back in the 70s?
There's a lot of differences, but basically the officers that are employed now, very well educated and well equipped. They're having to deal with things like the pervasive drug use throughout our society. They're dealing with that and people acting strangely because of drugs, and a lot of the drug folks have convictions that are felonies that don't want to quit hunting, safe, for instance. So the officers now are dealing with people, felons in possession of firearms, and they have full police powers. 1971, when I start, our powers were basically limited to serving orders of the court and fisheries or wildlife violations because we crossed over there. It's just a whole new ball game. Think of the closures. I just mentioned how many seasons were open. Now the folks are even looking at an enforcing Endangered Species Act, especially in the world of salmon and some steelhead. We never had anything like that. It's so complex. You almost need an attorney to read the fishing rules, and they can be interpreted differently by officers. I think there's a lot of discussion and issues on that. The officers and the biologists aren't communicating as well as they should.
And you detail that with some really interesting stories about decisions that biologists made that you had to enforce, and the biologists weren't there to explain why the enforcement was happening, and also about hatchery management, issues that go all the way back to the 70s and 80s that continue to haunt us today. Folks, again, the book is Fish Cop. It's by Tug Tuggle. Actually, you're going to want to look for it under J.W. Tug Tuggle. And I'm guessing it's available on Amazon?
It is through Kindle. I don't have the books themselves, the soft cover books available on Amazon yet. We're just working on that. I mean, this is just printed. I got boxes of books in my living room as I speak. The demand's been fairly high from the limited marketing I've done. And so I'm really encouraged there. I've got some good reviews. I've got a great review in The Real News in the January issue that I'm kind of proud of. So at Amazon, Kindle and Amazon is $8.99. And if you call me directly, I can hook you up with a book, signed autographed copy, first edition, for $20.
Well, the phone number to call, if you want to do it that way, to get an autographed book from Doug Tuggle, and it's a book full of fantastic stories. It's both a great fun read, and it's also very educational, too. The number, 360-754-1734. I know you didn't have your pen out. Go ahead and get it out now. Got it? Good. Here's the number again. 360-754-1734. That's 360-754-1734. You can talk to the author, Tug Tuggle. He will sell you a copy of his book, Fish Cop, and it's definitely a $20 investment that's worthwhile. If you want it as an ebook, just go to Amazon.com and look for Fish Cop in the book section. You'll find it right away. Tug, congrats on your first book. I'm enjoying the read, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much, John. I hope we can get together and do some fishing here not too long.
You and me both.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter and has what you need as a hunter, angler, hiker, paddler, camper, and outdoors enthusiast. They also carry an extensive assortment of firearms and ammunition you simply can't find anymore at many big box stores. On top of that, their knowledgeable staff is here to help you purchase the right gear so you can get the most out of your outdoor experience. Visit your local Sportsman's Warehouse store today or shop online anytime at sportsmans.com.
March Madness is coming to the Pacific Northwest, courtesy of O'Loughlin Trade Shows. Things kick off at the Tacoma Dome March 4th through the 7th with the Tacoma RV Show. From there, we head to Redmond for the Central Oregon Sportsman Show the 11th through the 14th. The Washington Sportsman Show returns to the fairgrounds in Puyallup the 17th through the 21st, and then we give you the biggest sports show in the entire nation. It's the Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show, along with the Portland Boat Show, both taking place March 24th through the 28th at the Expo Center in Portland. All of these shows are subject to government regulations, but be assured, O'Loughlin Trade Shows are taking all the necessary steps to make sure you have a safe and enjoyable experience. Find out more at otshows.com for March Madness in 2021.
We've got time for one more shot of Northwestern Outdoors Radio with John Cruz.
I'm glad you're back. Usually it's time for your Sportsman's Warehouse Trivia Question of the Week right now, but before we get there, I need to share some news with you. Sportsman's Warehouse, they were bought out last month by the Great American Outdoors Group, also known as Bass Pro Shops. Bass Pro, as you know, bought out Cabela's a few years back and bought out a couple of other companies too to form the Great American Outdoors Group. What does this mean to you as a consumer when it comes to shopping at Sportsman's Warehouse? Right now, not a whole lot. In fact, I don't expect to see much change at all in the first 6 months of this year. After that, you'll probably see some Cabela's and Bass Pro Shop merchandise in your local Sportsman's Warehouse stores, and I suspect there may be some store closures if a Sportsman's Warehouse store is located within a couple of miles of a Bass Pro Shop or Cabela's, but then again, maybe not, because some of the Cabela's stores I expected to close after that purchase stayed open, even though they were located very close to Bass Pro Shops here in the Northwest. The bottom line, you can still shop at your local Sportsman's Warehouse store right now, and I think for many months to come, and continue to expect the same great service and deals you've always gotten at America's premier outfitter. And with that, it is time for your Sportsman's Warehouse Trivia Question of the Week and your chance to win a $25 gift card. Here's your question. You've heard of national parks, national forests, and national monuments, but what about national grasslands? Yep, it's a thing, and you'll find one of them in northeast Wyoming. Located between the Bighorn Mountains and the Black Hills, you'll find 1.5 million acres of rolling prairie grasslands here that support one of the biggest herds of pronghorn in North America. Here's your question. What is the name of this national grassland found in Wyoming? Now, I understand you might have to look this one up unless you're already a Wyoming resident, but once you do, you can give us your guess on our Northwestern Outdoors Radio Facebook page. I hope you'll like and follow that page, too. You can also contact us through our website at northwesternoutdoors.com, and if you prefer, just give us your answer there through the Contact Us page. We've got to wrap things up, and I hope you made some New Year's resolutions you can keep. I know I did. And I hope you've got some fun ones, too, that involve spending more time in nature. Until next time, do take care, God bless, stay healthy, and make it a point to spend some time outdoors.